Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
We are joined by Luke Gu from Salvo's Legal again. Luke, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Noel.
Good to have you in here. It's been interesting because I think the first subject we were going to discuss today is to do with cyber hacking, and it has to do with perhaps, a lot of Australians very worried about what might be said about them. Just tell us what the story is.
Yeah, it's quite a very, very risque issue, Noel, in a number of areas.
It's the Ashley Madison dating service, isn't it, really?
Yeah, Ashley Madison is a unique website which is there to connect people who want to have an affair.
Oh.
So it's not simply a website for dating purposes. It goes that extra level in terms of the hopeful for those who are participating in anonymity associated with, the protection from being found out in having an affair. And what's happened was 7 days ago today, the site, which is based in Canada, has been hacked. And the hackers, being a fairly political group calling itself the Impact Team, seeking to have it and some associated websites shut down, claim to have stolen very, very, very personal and sensitive records relating to approximately 37 million users worldwide.
I mean, 37 million users' fantasies about what they'd like to do outside their lawful marriage or their relationship or what affair they'd like to have.
They claim to have compromised all of the company's data and that they have threatened to release all customer records, including the profiles with all of the customers' secret sexual fantasies.
Including, no doubt, their iPhone photos, et cetera, et cetera, in the
bathroom. Credit card details.
The whole thing.
Photos.
Good Lord.
Details of fantasies and all sorts of intimate.
Any Australians at risk?
Yeah, apparently somewhere near a million.
Good Lord. So that really is a bit of a problem. So when you look at it, I mean, you come from a law background, of course. Of course it's salacious, and of course we go, oh, good Lord. But, what sort of defence do any of these people have, and should they have any defence? Well, what's going to happen?
Well, there's a few things here. I mean, I guess as an interesting starting point, famously Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO of Google, once said, if you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. Not really a legal observation, but certainly one that's timely, I think. The difficulty is, once the information is out, if in fact the threats are valid, and there's some level of mixed validation from the website as to whether or not it thinks this organisation has properly stolen the information that it claims to have.
So it could have been a theft. It's a hacker theft, most likely.
Without question, it's a crime.
Right.
And it's a crime in the jurisdiction in which the website exists in Canada, a very serious crime, obviously. But more, personally, for each of those 37-odd million people, it is a very serious breach of their personal and private information. The difficulty is the private information is one that was subject to an engagement between them and the website rather than them and the hackers. So it really will fall back to the website to be able to respond or defend to any allegations that the customer's personal information has not been kept securely.
But if an Australian came to you and said, oh, I need help with this because I think, I've left all of my portrait shots dressed in my Batman suit and people are now going to find out about it. Can you do anything for me? Can Salvo's Legal do anything for somebody in that position?
Well, potentially. Look, it really depends on the facts of the particular website and what business they engage in within the Australian jurisdiction. But certainly Australia has privacy laws, which if the website and the way the data was stored in this instance were to have a connection with Australia, would provide a level of protection to the individuals. But I guess that's one thing, that is if there's a legal cause of action against the website. But this is something where damages are not necessarily going to be an adequate remedy. Mm. Once the data is out, if in fact it was to be released and the organisation conducting the cyber attack has said they're going to drip feed the information across the internet for as long as it takes, if in fact that's true and this happens, the things that are going to be the subject of damages are unquantifiable.
Right.
You're looking at marriages, relationships.
Because once the information's out, the disaster has happened, as it were.
Trust is gone.
Yep.
I mean, to a degree, there's a level of irony in it that the people who would be claiming the breach of trust are committing one. But from a legal point of view, a real question would be, you know, cash, as in a remedy financially against the website owners, is that going to be a sufficient outcome for those who fall victim to this this breach of their personal information?
Gee, and what's it looking like 7 days later? Has it sort of gone quiet, I think, hasn't it?
For now, there's some discrepancies across published material on the internet that 2,500 customers' details have been validated as having been stolen. Only two of them have been released publicly so far.
Oh.
So there has been an initial release, albeit in a very small dose.
Only two people that we know who are looking for an affair, basically. Oh, dear.
Well, I don't think they were in an affair with each other.
No.
So potentially four people, I guess. But it started. Whether it continues, I guess, depends on whether the attack was as substantial as has been claimed.
And your best legal opinion would be not to engage with the website in the first place, I imagine.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, some of the information that's come out of this is that people have been very frightened because they've actually used their personal credit cards when all the other data that they've used to put on the website, they've taken very concerted efforts to make anonymous.
Right.
But when it comes time to paying their subscription fee, they use their personal credit card, and
that
obviously
can be now connected.
The data is able to be connected.
To the Batman photos.
To your Batman photos, Noel, yeah.
Oh, dear. Look, the other story I think you can provide us some advice on, though, is liquor laws. Now, there's a proposed change in Queensland to bring them into line with New South Wales. Now, New South Wales has got some pretty, shall we say, efficient liquor laws at the moment.
Yeah, we saw about 18 months ago now, following the tragic deaths of two young men in New South Wales, Daniel Christian and Thomas Kelly, we saw some significant reforms in New South Wales that commenced in early 2014. And for some period of time, there was a little controversy over whether they would have the impact in reducing alcohol-related violence or whether it was going to be a disruption to small businesses and to licensees and that there was not going to be any substantial outcome in it. What's happened, though, is that in April this year, the relevant authority being the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research, which is an agency within the Department of Justice, released a formal report which answered a series of questions squarely as to whether or not the 2014 reforms to the New South Wales Liquor Act had reduced the incidence of assault. It specifically looked at the King's Cross and the Sydney CBD entertainment districts.
So has it improved?
Yes, significantly.
What sort of order of measure? How did they measure it?
Well, they did a range of very thorough studies.
Oh, I can see all of those diagrams you've got there. Yes.
But the long and short of it is that in the New South Wales, well, there's a range of outcomes, because you'll recall, Noel, that there were a range of measures implemented. One was the 1:30 a.m. lockouts.
Lockouts, yep.
So that hotels, registered clubs, nightclubs and karaoke bars in the Sydney CBD entertainment precinct and in the King's Cross precinct wouldn't let people back in if they left at or before 1:30.
And if you were there at 1:30, you were sometimes trapped in a dreadful bar and you just couldn't get out, or you had to
you
go
could
home.
Get out, but the only other
you
place
to
be
get
home.
Back in. Yeah, that'd be home. Yeah.
So it used to be you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here, and now it is you do have to go home.
I've heard from people that stay out that this sort of thing happens.
Yeah. And then the other important measure was a 3 a.m. cessation of alcohol being served in any of these venues. There was a freeze on the issue of new liquor licences. Across New South Wales, importantly, was a ban absolutely on takeaway alcohol sales after 10 o'clock.
Oh, really? So that after 10 o'clock? I wasn't aware of that. There you go. That's
you're not out late enough, Noel. So that, I guess, is something that is more dispersed than the concentrated examination within the Sydney CBD and King's Cross areas.
Well, the CBD thing has been quite, I mean, that's really been in the news, because I know some bars have actually shut, some businesses have shut that, you know, were relying on all that late night trade.
Yeah.
And basically alcohol and gambling and whatever else was going on at the time.
Yeah.
They have actually suffered, without doubt. So there has been a cost to some businesses. But you're saying that the results in terms of crime prevention are really very satisfying, and therefore Queensland's looking at this now?
Yeah, Queensland's looking at it. Well, just to give you some numbers, within the King's Cross area, they saw a 32.27% reduction in alcohol-related violence in the relevant period. In the Sydney CBD, the larger precinct area, a 25.929% reduction. And across the whole of New South Wales, they saw an 8.63% reduction.
That's big, isn't it?
So, I mean, if it saves a life, it's a very, very significant thing. But more so than just looking at the argument as to whether businesses are going to be suffering from this, there's obviously a converse where there is less violence. You have the human element, that is, people who are not suffering from, avoidable physical contact, but also the people who are in the business of helping people who suffer. So people in the hospitals, people on the front line, and ambulance.
Exactly what
officers.
I was going to say. The emergency departments have noticed a drop in people.
And
arriving
there's been specific feedback from St Vincent's Hospital, for example, that this has seen a huge impact in the reduction of alcohol-related violent instances.
The question is, you hear reports though, that it's moving outside, because I was reading only recently that it's moved up to Newtown because that's outside the really strict lockout area.
This study from Boxer, which is the authority, anticipated that. I'm aware of the article you're referring to, but it is isolated.
Right.
This specifically looked at something they called dispersed areas. So that is, if people are going to be leaving the city to get out of the lockout zone, because it is a very physically geographical, kind of like
close,
a visible fence.
Where they're going to take a taxi to, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. Next, so people thought, they looked at Newtown, they looked at Pyrmont, they looked at Bondi, they looked at Surry Hills. And they found
these are
it
all
was
inner
not,
cities,
yeah,
Sydney,
that within 4 or 5 kilometres, they found that it was not, in fact, having that disbursement effect of what was moving from King's Cross was moving to Bondi or Newtown.
Right, right.
The reality is the benefit of the reduction in alcohol-related violence from those specific key areas of King's Cross and the Sydney CBD far outweighed any increase, albeit even statistically irrelevant in the number of instances, any increase in any of those other areas. So looking at the measures as a whole, it would appear very successful.
And how close is Queensland to actually imitating this, and how much of it's been taken on board?
Well, Queensland has undertaken a level of consultation, which is important. I guess a lot of people are affected. This was a government election policy, and so it's got obviously a significant political imperative for the government to see it put through as a law. Queensland for some months has proposed a number of laws, a couple that are a little bit different. I mean, it certainly has adopted the New South Wales laws relating to the lockouts and the
1:30 lockout, you're either in or you're out. Then
the 3 o'clock shut off. But they've also looked at whether people would be able to be breathalysed by police. So that is people who are perceived to be disorderly patrons. Police would have the ability to formally breathalyse them so as to preserve evidence that they might need in order to prosecute licensees, managers and patrons who breach the Liquor Act.
Now, that is a step up. I've never seen that certainly around. That would be quite new, wouldn't it?
Some are considering it a little controversial. I mean, obviously, when you drive a motor vehicle, you're subject to random breath tests. The police in Queensland aren't proposing that these tests would be random. I take it they would, in practice, identify a person they believe is highly intoxicated, give them a direction. That person would be required to comply with the direction. The breath analysis would be undertaken. And immediately the police would be able to...
say your blood alcohol content is this.
Yeah.
You've been served too many drinks. You've been here for the last 2 hours. This licensee is in trouble.
Precisely. And that's one of the measures in New South Wales they look to do to utilise to impact the reduction in violence by placing some of the accountability upon the licensees. Very important that occur. The difficulty in New South Wales with the Boxer statistical report is that the period of time hasn't been significant enough to measure if, in fact, higher penalties and higher enforcement have had an effect.
It needs to go longer in terms of the real results, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, one would think, though, if there is a higher penalty on a licensee, there is a higher incentive to police their own premises to prevent patrons from becoming severely intoxicated such that there is a danger to them or others.
Gee, that's interesting, though. I mean, the very thought of, like, testing people inside licensed premises, it just strikes me as something that would, I think, alarm some people in terms of civil liberties.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Americans, I'm sure, would take great offence at it. In Australia, we may be a little more comfortable, I guess, given when we get behind the wheel of a motor vehicle, it's the norm and has been for some time. We take responsibility for ourselves before we turn the engine on and know that at any point in time we can be stopped and checked and be accountable to the law.
And this is an extension, of course, into public areas where, of course, your behaviour may affect somebody else
in terms of
violence.
Yeah, precisely. If you're going to consume a significant amount of alcohol, you're a risk to yourself or someone else, either by becoming a victim, mm-hmm. because you could be targeted for being someone unable to defend themselves,
yep.
or you could be a person who responds aggressively when you consume too much alcohol, in which case you could be a danger to others. So there is a degree of importance in the public safety, I would imagine, from mm-hmm. a measure like that. Obviously, the arguments in terms of privacy, civil liberties, are quite complex. I wonder, though, whether having given up that argument in the motor vehicle context, Australia has come further than America would allow itself to.
Well, how close is this? Are the laws up? Are they ready for enactment? How soon in Queensland?
Yeah, look, I think I don't have a date. I think that the arguments are continuing to be made politically and in the media. The examination to date has focused on whether the Queensland environment is in fact comparable to the Sydney and, you recall, the Newcastle situation was also examined some years ago. And Queenslanders are saying, look, Queensland is a different beast altogether. Queensland doesn't have the same violence issues as New South Wales has had.
Is that true? Is that provable that it doesn't?
Well, I think you'd have to look at the equivalent to Queensland.
Down in the
boxer.
Valley? You know,
yeah. I think, yeah, the Valley is particularly where the area of objection is coming from the nightclub lobby.
Yeah.
But the other issue is you have the tourism industry, particularly Surfers Paradise, the Gold Coast.
Of course,
late night shutouts would be very disruptive to
Knocks
that.
Knocks down profits.
Yeah. So
ruins extra taxi fares.
Yeah. So you're seeing a range of different interest groups there. But I think the consultation that has to date taken place is an important one. But you have to look at the bigger picture and what is the most important thing, and surely the safety of persons has got to be the highest priority.
In terms of public safety, certainly in New South Wales, the death of quite a number now of young men, innocent young men in the one punch
in
the violence has really galvanised New South Wales' opinion, certainly. And no doubt those same sorts of issues will strike Queenslanders.
Yeah, and look, in specifically on that point, the public outcry following those particular incidents certainly would have had some impact on the culture as a whole within Sydney and perhaps wider New South Wales relating to the tolerance of alcohol abuse.
Luke Geary of Salvos Legal, thank you very much for bringing us up to date with some of the legal and personal issues that are running in our country at the moment.
Thanks, Noel. Pleasure.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.